Hello, my name's Elaine Cooper and I live in Cambridge.
Hello, and I am Ian Cooper, and surprise, surprise, I live in Cambridge too, with Elaine.
This is good. But Elaine, you knew Schaefer in the 70s, so I'm interested to know your first encounter with Schaefer. Was that something intentional? Was it just kind of an accidental? And at the time, were you a Christian or were you not?
Well, to give a proper answer to that, I really have to go back just one step before meeting Schaefer, which was I grew up in South Africa. I was a final year student at the University of Cape Town in 1968, when a friend of mine whose English parents farmed in Zimbabwe invited me for a holiday. Their daughter and I were both Christians, and we went off to the back of beyond in Zimbabwe to this farm. And when we left, my friend's mother gave me a book, which she said had just been published, and she thought that as Christian about to be graduated students, we might enjoy having it. And the book turned out to be The God Who Is There. Well, I went back, and the book was an absolute revelation for me because I had become a Christian in my second year, had a wonderful experience of good Christians, but there was a real lack of integration between the Christian devotional life that I was learning about and the actual academics that I was involved in and having to come to terms with. And after I'd read The God Who Is There, it was just like lights going on, because he was talking in categories and terms, which was relating my being a Christian with how to live and how to think in a way that absolutely no one else had specially spoken about. After I left South Africa to go on some European travels, I knew about Swiss Le Bris because of having read the book. And in early 1971, I went as a guest to Swiss Le Bris and stayed there. In those days, you could be a guest for up to 10 days without paying anything. And I was there for, I think, just over a week. Staying in a little bed and breakfast with the Chaudé sisters. And I do remember my first night of going up to Farrell House, which is where the lectures were given, meeting Schaefer, and he was interesting and quirky and dressed in his breeches and with his little beard. And the first impression was that, my goodness, this man's got a terrific sense of purpose. And we met, we listened to the lectures, and I think the most striking recollection for me was that this was a man who was on fire with what he was speaking about and a sense of mission about really helping people to understand the culture, the ideas, the times they were living in. So his lectures were very prompt. He was always very prompt. They were very directed and they were always very powerful. And he was always, in a sense to me, giving new but challenging language and concepts that I had not experienced either in academics or in my Christian church life. Another aspect was his patience and his openness with the individual questions that students were asking at these lectures. And he would sort of lean forward and listen terribly intently to the questioners and the questions. And then he would give a very careful but always warm answering of the question. Now, the question answer thing was very important because when you asked a question, you actually grew in understanding, because often the question that you asked would be rephrased by him into a much bigger context than you would have imagined when you first asked it. So he lifted you up through your question. And I would say that there was the atmosphere of a man who didn't tolerate fools lightly, but who was never, ever demeaning of any question. But he took the question from that person and he raised them both up. So if you arrived being perhaps a bit light-hearted and just experiencing le bris, you would certainly not remain that way for very long because of the intensity and seriousness with which he was listening to your question and trying to make sense of it in the culture and who you actually were. But always very personable with individuals, while also he never hung around. There wasn't a lot of extra time and space, and I think at this time he was probably getting busier. This was in early 1971. There was a sense that time was short. He wanted to get on with, he had lots to do. And once Rookmarker came to le bris during that week, and there was very much a sense of these were two meeting of minds. And of course, Hans Rookmarker was a real heavyweight. And I never heard them discuss or debate or anything, but it was understood that that was, you know, a very particularly good relationship.
Yes, do you know that when Hans Rookmarker is installed at the chair, I think what it was, art and something at Free University, in his acceptance speech, it's quite marvelous. He gives so much credit to Francis Schaeffer. And I'd often thought, no, it's probably the other way around. And I thought, no, after reading that, no, that's not true. That Rookmarker felt greatly indebted to him. Because they met, as you know, earlier, before Rookmarker, I don't know if he'd finished an undergrad degree when they, you know, when they first met. But he does become, as you say, the heavyweight. So.
Yes.
Yes.
And in terms of Rookmarker and art, I think there's a slightly throwaway line in Frankie's book about, well, actually, Schaeffer was more interested in art and culture than he was in theology and so on. And I think that's an unfair comment, although I think it's very true that he was very interested in art.
Schaeffer,
yes. Yeah, and now, the other aspect of that first week at Swiss Le Bris was Schaeffer coping with the enormous amount of hospitality that happened at Swiss Le Bris. And he was always very gracious with what I would call incessant hospitality. It's breakfast, lunch, dinner. Not that he would appear at all the meals, but when he did, he was always there with a purpose of listening and good discussion. And of course, Edith Schaeffer just thrived in that. She loved it and she made it happen. But there was one occasion I do remember on Schaeffer's birthday, and it was just after church at the chapel, and Edith was collecting an astonishing number of people to come and help celebrate Schaeffer's birthday, and he looked quite crestfallen just at the sheer number of people who were going to be at his lunch table to celebrate his birthday. But the lunch was a thing of beauty. It was a wonderful discussion with wonderful content. So finding himself in these pressing situations, he always managed to just lift the occasion with his question, with his listening and his answers. So that was quite inspiring. I then went off and went to back to do some work and studies in Florence in Italy. And then after a period of personal difficulties, I returned to Le Bris in late 1975 and rented the little house that John Sandry had found called The Barn. And by this time, the lectures that Schaeffer was doing were being very well recorded. And he was very involved with his writing and producing the book, How Should We Then Live? Yes. Which I think was published in that year, 1975 or the following year. And during that period that I was there, I remember I had one time of a short time of prayer with Edith and Schaefer, and it was very memorable. Just a very direct sense of praying, believing in the efficacy of prayer, and yet also not over praying, and also very much human responsibility in the midst of the next steps. So there was a great sense of realism and warmth and humanity in my first encounters, which quite well. Not to mention the sheer intellectual fizz that was going on in terms of my studies and thinking. So.
So as you listen to him, and you're saying the intellectual fizz. But the way he could speak about these most important and profound ideas seemed to be done in such a way that people understood what was being said.
Very much so. And it was never, ever, ever just the intellectual. It was always brought back down to an integration of your growing, if you were a Christian, growing as a believer, that there was, there had, you were aiming at this wholeness. And if you weren't a believer, you were being challenged to see, well, were there inconsistencies in the way you were thinking, because you were sort of saying one thing, but actually there were apparent contradictions in what you might be living. So yes, but it was always very understandable and very warm, very human. You never felt you were more head or more heart, or more Christian, and less anything else. It was all of a package, and that was very, very attractive.
Yeah, I think for Schaefer, maybe I'm not right on this, but that Christianity was not something that we added to our life. It was our life.
Precisely. It was the truth was what you could live from.
Yes.
Yes, and into.
Yeah.
Yes.
Ian, you did not spend or meet him a lot directly, but you were much involved in the film series.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Whatever Happened to the Human Race?
Yes, that's right.
Well, tell me a little bit about what that was like.
Well, before I do that,
sure.
If I may,
yes.
I sort of have a little backstory.
Good.
In the sense that I was a young student at Cambridge University here at Jesus College. And I had come from a missionary background out in Africa, and I had been to a very Christian school in this country, and I was a committed Christian. But I came up to Cambridge realizing that I needed a more adult and a more mature sort of Christianity, and I was hopelessly disillusioned insofar as I found that the Christian Union, which was and the church that I was involved in, was interested in Bible study, prayer and evangelism, and more or less nothing else. So that I felt in the end that I was just part of a small subculture that was looking for psychological certainty and a certain kind of social conservatism. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is not what I was looking for. And then the other problem that I had was that when I spoke to the academic theologians, they were all liberal in their theology and had big doubts about the Bible. And I thought to myself, well, these are the people who are really supposed to know. And certainly the Christian Union, the people there, can't speak to these people or answer these people. And therefore I thought to myself, you know, what is the point? Now, this was, you have to understand, right in the middle of the 60s. I came up to university in 1963. When I came up to university, we all wore sports jackets, tweed jackets and ties and proper trousers. By the time I left, everyone was in jeans and in leather jackets and singing the Beatles. I mean, it was a kind of real cultural change. And so to find a Christian faith that didn't relate to the culture, that didn't ask questions or answer questions, I found that sort of deeply disappointing. And in fact, sadly, I joined the revolution, as it were, the 60s, and was involved in politics and a whole lot of things like that. And it took me some time before I realized that the secular scene that I had got into had absolutely even less answers than I had assumed that the Christian scene had. And it was interesting insofar as there was one girl I knew at university who had been to the Brie. And she knew that I was troubled in my faith or lack of faith and sort of was giving up. And she said, you must go to the Brie, you see. She said, it's different. And I was, I'm afraid by this time, too cynical, thinking, oh, this is just another bunch of evangelicals who will come out with the same sort of answers and attitudes. And anyway, I can't afford to go to Switzerland and find that out. So I didn't go. However, again, my sister heard that Schaefer was in London. And she said, you must come and listen to him. So I thought, all right, I'm going to listen to him. And I was impressed because here was somebody speaking the language of the university. Here was somebody speaking the language of truth. And he was going on about how, if you sort of look at the, he was doing his sort of historical survey of Western culture and about how with the loss of the Bible, people had lost absolutes. And as a result, they were ending up with just purely human absolutes, or in fact, a kind of relativism, though ideologically that could be, in the case of communism or something, that because their relativism turned out to be a sort of absolutism. And I was thinking, I was listening to all this, and I thought, this was, you know, this is quite good. But I had the kind of the killer question, which was, because I had studied history, I thought to myself, here you are talking about a loss of absolutes leading to relativism. But actually, when we had studied history, when Europe had been Christian, Christianity as a culture seemed to have led to a very sort of absolutist notion and a totalitarian notion that you couldn't disagree. You know, I mean, if you disagree too much, you'd end up on the stake. You know? So in that sense, perhaps we needed a little bit of freedom and a little bit of change. So I was going to ask him this question, and there were loads and loads of other questions, and being a sort of young person, you're sort of trying to get your head clear and you're trying to get your question out. And then by the time I was ready to ask it, the meeting came to an end. And I thought, oh, well, there you go. But then again, somebody else, people didn't go up on me that easily, if you see what I mean. Somebody else gave me the book, The God Who Is There. And again, I thought, oh my goodness, this is interesting. And this is helpful, but it's all predicated on the truth of the Bible. And we know that's not true. We know that nobody's really, no evangelicals have really answered the sort of biblical criticism. At least that's what I thought. Not that I had read that much, but you know, that was the kind of perception. And it took my life hitting the buffers in a big way for me even to kind of consider going to a Libri. And I then, my sister again, when things were quite bad for me, discovered, in fact, that there was an English Libri which had just opened. And I thought, well, it's only in England, you know, that's not too expensive and yeah, it's not a huge commitment and life is really awful at the moment, I better go down there. And so I did. And I think I was just hugely encouraged and basically I came back to being a Christian there. And it was because people's questions were being answered, that there was this language of truth. And yet at the same time, it wasn't just an intellectual thing. I think in some ways, the things I found almost most helpful were the graces before meals, which were very personal, very real, very sort of matter-of-fact and everyday, but really authentic. You sort of felt that people were really talking to God. And I found that great. And then I also was, it was fun being at Libri. We had these amazing country dances and things. We played volleyball. Being a Christian, which had always been a sort of rather onerous kind of, because I came from a slightly legalist, well, legalistic background. Being a Christian was always a kind of, you know, a duty. It was always a bit grim. Well, at Libri, being a Christian was life-affirming. And basically, Ranald and Jerem, who were there, reflecting on Schaefer's sort of whole approach at the Swiss Livery had just produced their book, The Humanist of Spiritual Experience, and that was terribly important in understanding that being a Christian was about being restored to what you were supposed to be and being the kind of person that God really wanted you to be, and something which was really positive and creative and good. Oh, and the other thing was, there was wonderful music. You know, people were playing the piano. There was art on the walls. The meals were done in such a way that, you know, there were flowers and candles and things, and you just felt, oh my goodness, these people actually really care about living. And I went to aunts who had texts on the wall and sort of long and meaningless graces and sort of talking about missionaries in far off parts of the world, which as a child I had always sort of found it gloomy and depressing. So Libri was completely different in this respect, and I think it was this mixture of both serious answers and serious thought about the culture and about what Christianity was really saying in response to the culture, and coming out actually with better answers. There was a sense of that you could have a sense of real intellectual self-confidence. You weren't kind of getting rid of your brain, but actually Christianity had better answers. And I think the most important thing was really you realised more clearly that the secular culture really didn't have answers and was in a real, with its sort of philosophical materialism, was in a real mess. So that was all huge and encouraging. So that's really sort of my backstory before I got involved.
No, that's excellent, thank you.
With the film project, yeah.
So you did attend the Libri here in England.
Yeah.
Did you ever, I know Schaefer would come and speak occasionally, did you ever meet Schaefer while he was at those?
I remember meeting Mrs. Schaefer when she came. When Schaefer himself came, by this time he was hugely busy.
Yes.
And we sort of saw him from afar. I was first of all a student and then I was a helper. I think the interesting thing is when the How Should We Then Live film project came out, there was at one level we were glad. Here was Schaefer trying to kind of give a response to Kenneth Clark's Civilization series. But another level, I think some of us felt, oh my goodness, he's kind of joining the system, because we were all very 60s people, if you see what I mean. And Frankie came out with this big film, this big advertising, and Schaefer's this big philosopher and this big guru and this, that, and the other. And we thought, oh my goodness, we don't want to be involved in that. And there was a slight kind of criticism about that. And I'm not sure if we felt, this was after, obviously, Frankie's first film. We didn't think, being sort of very critical kids as we were, that the filming was good enough, if you know what I mean. But having said that, the more I looked at the film, because I then later on became a worker, and I used the film a lot, because, and having studied history, I felt that more or less Schaefer had got a lot of it right. And though there were people who were criticising him, he was a little bit wrong about Aquinas, or was a little bit too golden-aged about the Reformation, or about this, and I thought most of it actually really made sense, and gave, and I think this is one of the interesting things, in some ways, going to Libri was a much better education than going to university, because you suddenly began to put all things together and make sense of the culture and see where it was going and where it had come from, in a way in which when you're at university, because it was so specialised and because there was no overall framework, no overall picture, you couldn't actually put it, what you were learning, into anything that really made any coherent sense intellectually, let alone actually then also made sense about the kind of life you lived and the kind of person you were trying to be. And this was the big thing. So, I mean, these are some of the good things that I think came out of it.
It's interesting because you're a history,
you're
back in the ground history, and I think that most of us, history, philosophy, would look at some of the things in How Should We Then Live and say, you didn't get it quite right here. But when we step back and see, well, what was the intent of what he was doing? You have to say, it was marvelous. because it did exactly that, didn't it? It gave the big picture.
It's just the broad brushstrokes.
And it connected the dots.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Right? You know, Richard Weaver has the book that came out in 1948, Ideas Have Consequences. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly what Schaefer was saying and doing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, but you've studied history, you might correct me on this, but I didn't know of any evangelical at that time was doing anything in the area of intellectual history.
No, I mean, the only person the only people you can really think of would be Catholic historians like Christopher Dawson and people like that.
Yes.
You know, the Catholics were doing it, but not the evangelicals. No. So Schaefer's sort of first attempt, if you know what I mean, wasn't bad.
People have criticized him that he wasn't really informed, but he was informed.
Well, I think on the history, I mean, he spoke to people, he'd listened to people, yes. And he read a lot. He wasn't a scholar, he wasn't an academic, but hey, for goodness sake,
yeah.
You know, he was a busy guy and he was doing a lot of stuff, and he got it, I think he sort of got the culture right.
Oh.
He got the last 500 years pretty much right, overall, in terms of the shape and the direction and the consequences. I don't have a problem with that, not on the history. Yeah.
It was massive in my thinking.
Yeah.
I think the evangelical world, he awakened evangelical consciousness. Maybe it's an overstatement, but I think that evangelicalism, in the best sense of the word, would not be where it is today had it not been for Schaefer. He might not be the only one, but Schaefer played a large part.
Oh, I think he played a huge part. I mean, you'd have sort of C.S. Lewis in this country, who had been hugely influential and helpful, and of course also in the States. But Lewis wasn't sort of culturally really up to date with what was happening in the 60s, etc. And nor did he refer to what was going on the continent in terms of existentialism and all that kind of thing. So, and Schaefer got people intellectually engaged, he got people culturally engaged, and I think that people like John Stott took their cue from him in terms of them getting themselves involved in these things. And I think Schaefer really changed the evangelical conversation and changed it for the good.
Yes.
And then lots of people also went into their academic careers, mm-hmm. inspired by what Schaefer had done. And even though some of them ended up criticizing some aspects of what he'd done, well, hey, you know, that's what you're trying to be an academic for. So I think his influence, sort of culturally, on evangelicalism was enormous. And yet at the same time, it wasn't just an intellectual thing. There was this whole integration, his very involvement in the whole political thing made people get involved in politics. Later on, perhaps, there were some aspects of it you might want to be critical of, but trying to get evangelicals into the political scene was just... That was good, because they just hadn't been involved.
Well, you could say we found that out when we did the Whatever Happened to the Human Race series, because there was very little involvement of the Christians in the pro-life issue, because the issues were not being spoken about in any, again, bigger way. It was just you were either for it or against it. And when you wrote the English edition of Whatever Happened to the Human Race, and you met Koop, and then Schaefer came off, he was starting to struggle with cancer.
Yes.
And so during that time, he was pushing on with the tour, totally committed to doing it. I think we had four venues in England, and he spoke. And there was a real mobilization there with the Christian Medical Fellowship, the Christian Lawyers Fellowship, various university groups, and I think it's certainly in terms of the English scene, that tour was very important in mobilising a social conscience this country.
Well, I think it's more than that in some sense. As far as the pro-life issue is concerned, and this whole What Happened to Human Race book and film series was concerned, up until then, the pro-life issue in this country had been entirely a Catholic issue.
Yes.
And evangelicals just weren't involved. And in fact, most of the evangelicals who were in the Christian Medical Fellowship were fairly soft on abortion because they thought that it was needed for social reasons, because it was poor people who needed it. But it was mostly because they hadn't really thought about it. And when we started with the film series, etc., part of our job was to go around and tell the churches to get involved. And of course, one of the things we did was to get in touch with the pro-life groups who were all Catholic, who were thrilled that we came, who actually, and couldn't believe it. Oh, at last, they were saying, you guys have sort of, you know, switched on, you've seen what's taking place. And so that was hugely important. And the only evangelical organization that was kind of remotely politically active at the time was an organization called the Nationwide Festival of Light, which later on became called what it is called to this day, Christian Action Research and Education, or CARE, which is the sort of England's answer to Dobson's CARE. What's he called? His CARE for the Family, is it?
Focus on the Family.
It's not quite the same, but it's the leading evangelical organisation involved in pro-life stuff, pro-family stuff, sort of standing for Christian standards in public life. And they had just been involved against, really, on the issue of pornography. Mm. That was the only issue that they had kind of reacted to. They were a kind of reaction against 60s permissiveness. Mm-hmm. They got involved in the whole pro-life thing. And they were the people that helped the evangelical scene get involved. And they got involved because of the film series, because of Schaefer and Coop. So it made a big impact on that front. And since then, the pro-life thing, the pro-family thing has been very much part of the Christian scene. And it wasn't just CARE, for example, it was the Christian Institute, who were also very influenced. So it made a huge difference. And I think the other area also, in terms of the arts, mm-hmm. you got people who were involved in the arts and they were somehow, Christians were given permission to be interested in the arts, permission, yeah. And encouragement and support that the arts were important. Schaefer's little book, you know, Art in the Bible, mm-hmm. that little booklet, was hugely important. So was it the Arts Centre Group?
The Arts Centre Group, yes, Nigel Goodwin.
Which was one of the first to be involved, but there's a whole lot of others that have grown out of that. So it wasn't just politics, the arts as well.
Well, and film. And Schaefer really understood that the filmmakers and the artists and the poets and the so on were the new philosophers. They were the ones of the secular world. They were setting the stage.
Well, they were mediating the culture in a way.
They were mediating the culture. And you had to take them seriously. It wasn't just a frivolous, this is indulgent, but this is actually serious. And you have to think about these things. And what are you going to put in there?
I was in conversation with a Cambridge don, well-known, and we were talking about a few things, and I said, we were talking about art, and kind of given his background, I just thought I would throw this out and say, well, did you ever read anything about Schaefer on this? And his face just lights up, and he said, he's the one, that little book, Art in the Bible, he said, really kind of helped to focus me on how to deal with this. So he was, we'll never know, will we? The people who were influenced, though, as you indicate, some went into the academy, some went into medicine, and they went into a number of different things. He not only did the political scene, but he also was one of the first evangelical voices, though that it never did catch on, and that was in the whole area of creation care.
Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting you say that, because I had an intern at the Work of Christian Heritage here, who was an American girl who was doing stuff with agriculture, actually, and she was doing research on how to make biofuels. And she was wanting to do a little dissertation on the differences between English attitudes to evangelical attitudes to conservation and to creation care. and American attitudes. And I was having to say to her, because she was saying basically the American evangelical scene aren't interested in the stewardship of the creation, not interested in the environmental movement at all. They think it's pagan, or they think it's socialist, or they think a whole lot of things. And I said, but the thing you have to tell them is that it was Schaefer who wrote The Pollution and the Death of Man. And that was a key book, which gave a lot of people, you know, a real sort of direction.
Yes.
And yet it was a book, unfortunately, which people hadn't taken enough interest in, except over here.
Yeah.
Now that was, I think it's partly because Europe is left less sort of conservative, politically. It's more open to kind of liberal ideas, political ideas. And people could see that there was a problem with the environment, and people could see that that needed to be addressed, and that Christians ought to do something about it. And Schaefer's book was really helpful in that respect.
Yes, he took on Lynn White,
yep.
Which is still, it's still being talked about.
Yes.
I go to conferences on these matters.
Yeah.
Of course, I would say that the evangelical world in America has, not wholeheartedly or in large numbers, but a number of evangelicals are now involved in the creation care. But precisely right, I don't want to be overly critical of my own tribe,
right.
But the fact is that we didn't really get on board until the world, the secular world, started talking about it. And I hope that we started talking about it because we really saw it as an issue, not that we just wanted to be relevant. I can't judge motives, and I shouldn't, but sometimes it's in the back of my head. There's not much else back there, so it takes a lot of things just take up residence there. The idea of the intellectual, the fact is that the Christian intellectual, and I don't mean that it's just somebody who uses big words, but who thinks deeply about life and makes connections, is very, I think, intellectually satisfying. As you had indicated, you look at the naturalist and realize there really isn't an answer there.
Right.
But they get most of the press, so it appears like there is an answer there.
Right.
Well, I'm going to come back to whatever happened to the human race. But now, Elaine, you've given me a good picture of your impressions about Schaefer. So this might be a little bit of repetition, but maybe not. What were the ideas that you heard? Was it that you heard new ideas, or were you just hearing somebody talk about them in a way that made sense to you?
I think really it was Schaefer banging on about true truth, which was the big central flame that one had to keep coming back to. What did it mean? And if it meant something, then it meant actually there is no alternative to what is here. If this is truly it, this is reality, and everything he is saying is pointing towards that. That truth is the light by which one is trying to understand things. And I think for me, particularly as time went on and you started getting postmodernism creeping in, which again, I think in Escape from Reason, he is setting the showing how the future would be going badly wrong if we didn't understand this. So for me, the big key ideas were, if what the Bible is saying is truthful communication from an infinite personal God, then really there is no other place. I am nowhere if I'm not understanding what the Bible is saying.
Ultimately, there's just going to be irrationality. This was the irony, in a sense, that the people who were claiming that they were the reasonable people, because they had cut themselves off from the source of an infinite personal God, they were just left with their own finite minds. Their own finite minds are just going to come up with a relativist and postmodern view of truth. And they just didn't. And Schaefer kind of could see that.
Yes.
He saw that. And that was very helpful as postmodernism started becoming the flavor of the decade, and everything was literally just fragmenting and going every which way. And And so I think that was probably, those were the biggest ideas. And that if something was true, then it had to be true in a sense, even though it would be changing through generations and centuries, what was the truth at the heart of that? And so an extremely steadying, grounded feeling that, you know, the Bible has gone through millennia of interpretation, that we can, in the 21st century, still be affirming what is basically the truth of man, of what God has said, and the world we inhabit, however we've interpreted it. And a just incredibly grounding sense, so that when postmodernism really started hitting, and I was involved in education, it was like, education's a total waste of time. If postmodernism is what is happening, you know,
What can you teach people?
Yes, assessment is just purely an illusion, a figment of professional educators to say something is better than knowing than something else. And
well, interestingly, you felt the whole educational scene, there was a kind of almost a fear of being authoritative about anything, because people were kind of so relativized, in a sense, that how can we teach these people anything, and let alone how can we insist on any decent sort of behavior? And there was a kind of standing back.
And a deconstructing of things. So grammar wasn't being taught, because that was, you know, power trip by educators. And behavior, well, you must let people express themselves and so on.
And a kind of optimistic view of human nature, you know. Yes. These kids are nice and learning must be fun, and people lost it. It was a big shame. And unfortunately, the people who suffered most from it, from the kids in the poorer schools, the kids who needed the structure, who needed the help, who needed the discipline more than anyone else. But actually, coming back on in terms of one of the Schaeffer's ideas that were most important for me, was his whole, this rather funny phrase that he used to use, of the mannishness of man. Because Schaeffer pointed out that it's Christianity, only Christianity, that actually makes sense of our human experience. That if you take a materialist philosophy, you're just reduced to being no more than a sort of sophisticated and clever animal. And all the things that you really care about, truth, beauty, goodness, and all these things can only be explained in terms of the personhood of God. Because it's he who makes sense of who we are. And so in a sense, if you look at yourself and you look at other people, you see a bit of God, because... And how else can you explain that? How else can you explain that personhood, which they clearly have? And I was just reading a book recently by a philosopher called Julian Baggini, called The Ego Trip. And this is, he was talking about the fact that the one thing we are most certain of is our sense of self. He says, if you go and look at the brain and you look at the neurons firing in the brain, you will not find that self. So he's reduced to explaining that sense of self as an ego trick. It's the brain playing a trick on you. I think to myself, is that an answer? It might be easier to say that we're made in the image of God, and that's why we have this sense of self and all the things that go with it. And Schaeffer, I thought, was very, very helpful in actually saying, well, who are you as a person, and how can you explain that without a personal God? And I always have felt that one of the most helpful things.
Yes.
Because you can sort of listen to academic debates about the Bible, but when it comes to human beings, you know, we can all examine ourselves and then look at other human beings and say, well, how do we make sense of ourselves? So
yes, he had this, he was able to bring together what he would call, I think he used it, glorious ruins or something like that. Where here's a man who traveled in 47 across war-torn Europe for 3 months, saw the devastation, and then, you know, hunger and all that that brought. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, he could walk into a museum and see just wonderful works of art. And mm-hmm. you could look at history. And, well, how could you explain that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're glorious because we're made in the image of God.
Yeah.
But we can do very ugly things because we're fallen.
Yeah.
That gave an answer. Now, whether or not a person wanted to accept it or not,
yeah.
But that was an answer that seemed to me to be beyond contradiction.
Right.
That and this idea that I'm not sure which one of you mentioned it, but the idea that you could, I think you mentioned, Ian, growing up in kind of a fundamentalist,
yeah,
which I did. Well, I didn't become a Christian until I was 20, but that was the tribe,
yeah,
that I was became a part of. And grateful, I'm not, I want to make it so yeah, clear that they were wonderful people, they loved the Lord, but I wouldn't have signed on for yeah, everything. But that was that sort of, don't ask a question. This is the truth, I'm yeah, telling you.
Yeah.
And now don't ask a question. And if you did, then you might be suspect as to whether or not you were in the tribe or not. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me that something that stands out with Schaefer. Maybe you think it doesn't. But on the one hand, he could be so confident of the truths mm-hmm, as revealed in Christ. But at the same time, when talking to another person, be open enough to listen to what that person had to say.
Absolutely.
Do you think that's true?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, that was the that was just one of the excellent things about it, was that he was prepared to entertain objectively all sorts of points of view and give them due consideration, and also care about the people who took these points of view, whether they were the writers or whether it was the person he was speaking with, and take them seriously. Yes. And as a result of that, you were prepared to listen to what his answer was, you know, if you were not a Christian, because it took me a little bit of time to become a Christian. But I thought, well, yes, this is a genuine discussion, you know.
And it wasn't a trick.
No, it wasn't a trick.
No, no. It wasn't some kind of a, you know, well, this will pretend.
No, listen.
But...
I know this was the real thing.
Yes.
No, this was the real thing. That was very important.
Yes.
Yeah, so within his own terms of unity and diversity, it's like the truth was there, and all the presentation of all people was the diversity, which could be pointed to that. I mean, just a wonderful seamlessness.
Yes.
Mediated with lots of patience, lots of very good listening, and love, I think, really.
And that was something that had plagued humanity. How do we answer the question? Unity, diversity, being and becoming.
Mm-hmm.
That is even, you know, we find those things coming up in the early philosophers.
Mm-hmm.
And then Plato tries to work it out. And then Aristotle and the atomists, and everybody's trying to work it out. And they all have a piece of the truth, and it works until you push it on it too hard, and it falls apart.
Yeah.
But Christianity really did answer the question
mm-hmm,
of the one and the many, the unity and diversity. Mm-hmm. I think that was what probably attracted, one of the things that attracted me,
mm-hmm,
being philosophically inclined.
Yeah, yeah.
That gave the answer.
Mm-hmm.
But with postmodernism, and chatting to some of my philosophy friends, Andrew, what started happening was you couldn't even use those categories anymore. I mean, there was no universal. Yes, there were particulars, and that's what every particular just had to be, its particular. There was nothing holding it together. And so your old classical system of philosophy had completely been scuppered, and it was a free-for-all. And I think in Escape from Reason, he talks about how really when the modern theologians started to move into their upper story, neo-existentialism, they said that biblical Jewish thought was not at all true. It was just experiential, and Greek thought was too rationalist. And I think he says, no, in fact, the wedge should have been much further along, because like with Greek thought, and in fact, I even wrote down a little quote from it because it is such an important one, it's been an important one, is that truth is much closer to the Greek view than to the modern liberal view, in the sense that it affirms that which is part of the mannishness of man, the longing for rationality, that which can be reasonably thought about and discussed in terms of antithesis. So sort of holding the whole together, which on a history of philosophy is very helpful.
Yes.
Indeed.
Yes.
Very helpful.
And it plays into so many of the ideas that you've already spoken of, that when you lose the universal and you only have particulars, we see how that worked out in the area of morals, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of leads me to the what you were doing, if you want to say anything more, as you worked with whatever happened to the human race.
Well, in relation to this sort of drift to relativism,
yes.
One of the things, because there's no absolute truth, there's no God, we have to decide what to believe, and we basically make it up. We invent truth, and then we also invent morality to suit our particular situation. And that becomes a wonderful excuse for junking things you don't like, particularly in relation to sexual ethics. So you can use your newfound relativism to get rid of a whole lot of things which you find inconvenient. But the big irony that I have noticed with the whole relativist liberal culture is that these people who at one minute are sort of saying, do your own thing, the next minute are wagging the moral finger, because these are the people who believe in political correctness. And these are the people who will shake their fist and be unbelievably absolutist at one minute and then relativist at the next. So there's this kind of incoherence that's taking place, this inconsistency all the time. So it's a big irony that the relativism ended up with political correctness. I just think to myself, oh, really? How do you do that? I think Schaefer would have been, in some senses, not amused, he'd be saddened to see, oh, how ridiculous can you get? One of the other things was that you could see this idea that freedom is the great thing that we now have because we can all be relative and all of that. And yet at the same time, people were saying, oh, but we're programmed. It's our genes. It's our background. These things program us. And, well, if you're programmed, where does your freedom come from? You think to yourself...
An illusion.
But you think to yourself, do people really see these problems with this kind of secular relativist view? And it's depressing how sort of blind people are. People who like to make out that they're being very critical and they're very thoughtful and this, that, and the other. They don't see the sort of the great weaknesses of the system that they adhere to.
That came out in chapter 4, though, didn't it, of whatever happened to the human race?
Well, yes, but I don't think he saw it quite in the terms that it's sort of developed into, if you know what I mean. Yeah. It's just become more acute than in Schaefer's day,
yes.
In a sense.
Because here we have this matter that, of course, they don't catch it because they don't live in a coherent world.
Right.
So they don't demand it of themselves.
Right.
Mm.
So you can have this belief, X, for this occasion, and you can have non-X as a belief for another occasion, and you say, but that's not...
Yeah.
See, there's,
they contradict.
Yeah, there's no connection there. So it's very, I think that's very one of the issues that we have to face.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why I think Schaefer is so relevant for our day,
mm-hmm.
is that he faced the existentialist. Post-modernity is just a really...
It's a continuation.
It's a kissing cousin.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that, because
right.
I've always thought that really it's the same.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Precisely.
Yeah.
It's exactly the
same. But you see, in America, I think you have far more provision for a higher Christian education for your people than we do in Britain. The secular university is... We don't have Christian universities in...
We don't have independent universities. We've got one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually two, I think. Another one's just open. But essentially, the whole of higher education is funded by the state. And is fundamentally secular. Well, actually, it's rather curious. I mean, in Cambridge here, every college has a chapel. You see?
Yes.
And you have the divinity school here. And actually, there's two evangelicals in that divinity school, genuine evangelicals.
Both American?
No, Simon Gavichol.
Oh, Simon, yes.
So, in a funny sort of way, and this is a country which has the Queen who's governor of the church, so in a funny sort of way, we have... Formally, there is Christianity, if you like, but in practice we're a much more secular society, and you certainly see that in the higher education system. So there are not many independent Christian voices critical of what's going on. And when Christians go from school into university, Christian kids go, it's much, much more difficult, because really they're just having to cope with a secular system, which can be quite aggressive. And that's actually one of the things we're trying to do here at Christian Heritage.
Right.
But
well, at this school too.
Yes.
You know, this is again we're trying to capture this true truth and
yes.
Mannishness and knowledge is something you can find in unity. it's not all fragmented.
And see, that was really what I thought that Schaefer touched on postmodernity, though I think it goes by most people, and that is the last series, the last episode in whatever How Should We Then Live,
right.
Called Fragmentation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's precisely what it is. It's fragmentation. It's you've got nothing to hold it together,
right?
Yeah. So all you've got now are these particulars, and it shows up in almost every discipline that you can imagine today in the Western world. And Schaefer would say, I read it, and it was in the God who was there, that Christianity is true because it's true to what is there.
Yes.
That's
exactly.
It's what reality actually is.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I've always found that, I found that really helpful. I've got one quibble,
yep.
one area of criticism.
Yep.
Having been working in Le Brie,
mm-hmm.
And having sort of been in that whole intellectual atmosphere, coming up to Cambridge was really instructive, because one of the things I was aware of in Le Brie, because when one was answering people's questions and all of that, is there are very few of us in Le Brie who know anything about science. I couldn't think of anyone amongst the Le Brie staff who actually had a science degree, apart from Barry Senior, and that was in physics. And when I came up here,
Cambridge is all
Cambridge,
about science.
Cambridge is a very sciencey
mm-hmm.
place. And there are an awful lot of evangelical Christians who are scientists. And in fact, actually, it's more difficult to find an evangelical Christian who's in the arts here.
Mm.
Because ironically, even though science is sometimes seen as a problem for evangelicals or for Christian faith, there are a lot of evangelical scientists and a lot of scientists who are Christians, not necessarily evangelicals. But I realised that on the whole issue of origins, I didn't know very much. And Le Brie didn't know very much. And basically Schaefer didn't know very much on this issue. Because when I was just thinking about it, because I got in touch with people like the theistic evolutionists. Up here you could have the ID people, the theistic evolutionists, the old earth creationists. There's a whole mix. And there's some extremely informed people. Both informed in terms of what Genesis is saying, both informed and in terms of what the science is saying. And I thought to myself, oh, this is, I have to do, you know, my homework. And there was a steep learning curve. And there's the Faraday Institute here and all of this. So I had to get up to speed on this. And I realized that when one was reading Schaefer's Genesis in Space and Time, that really is predicated on a kind of theologically young earth creation, insofar as that for him, the human fall was the source of all natural suffering, death, disease, and disaster type thing. And it's quite clear that then people came to the Brie and said, look, actually, Schaefer, the world is really old, and there's been abnormality, there's been death, disease, and disaster way before there were any human beings on the planet, you know what I mean? Which then raises the big question of, well, in what senses was the world good? Which it was a strong thing in Le Brie, that there was a good, strong, a beautiful creation, good creation, which then went wrong as a result of human sin. So the fall was heavily emphasized. And the difficulty was, well, clearly things had gone wrong before the human fall, and how could you explain that? And in his little booklet, Genesis and Space and Time, he tried to address that insofar as he acknowledged yes, that the earth could be very old, and that there wasn't any problem in terms of biblical criticism that you could understand that. And he acknowledged that yes, the earth had been there'd been death, disease, and disaster, the abnormality, as he called it, before the human fall, which he kind of speculated on as to why that might be the case. And I think mentioned C.S. Lewis's idea of the angelic fall being the
He does an escape from reason too.
And I just thought, well, that isn't really coherent insofar as was the earth good before the human fall or not? And if it was not good, what was responsible for it being bad? And and what sense do we make of the fall, the human fall, now? And because it does seem to be the case that death, disease, and disaster existed, you know, just before human beings were ever here. And in which case, how do you explain that? Because
he would say that the Bible speaks not exhaustively, and what it says we take up to that point, and then we can't know exhaustively every.
He didn't know much about science. Nobody in the brain knew much about science, and he wasn't really able to address. So I think that's a weakness.
Well, I think the science has moved so much.
I would say that. Yeah. Well, now of course you see, one of the big things that's been argued is that the genetic evidence seems to suggest that we have we and the higher primates share the same sort of ancestors, and that tends to confirm that the fossil record. People would argue. It's not completely.
Oh, there's a big conference coming up, isn't there?
It's not completely settled, but people who take the Bible seriously tend to take that view. Certainly here, you're much more aware of that. So I sort of feel, and that maybe just be, you know, hey, he just wasn't around at the right time, you know, to get all this sort of stuff. If he'd lived longer, he might have been able to address these sorts of concerns and these sorts of difficulties. But that's been the only kind of real weakness of Le Bris. But as I say, you know, he was good at a lot of things. Yeah. He can't do it all.
Well, I think Schaefer used to say, if you want perfection or nothing, you'll get nothing every time.
Yeah, yeah. No.
And so no thing is perfect, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
And none of us cover all the bases, but the main thrust of existentialism that was raging across Europe at that time, and then of course came to America, working its way west to east. And you mentioned Lewis, but C.S., well, he dies in 63, so he doesn't really get to see this, but I think he is dealing with the atheism that had fallen in on England at that time. The World War One, but even World War Two. World War One. As I study history,
I don't think C.S. Lewis ever read Sartre or had any interest.
It wasn't his world.
He was interested in the classical world. He was interested in the medieval world.
Yes,
and he was interested in the Norse world.
That's right.
But modern continental philosophy
It was not in his world.
It wasn't his generation either, because he was growing up in before the First World War, and then in the 20s, that's where he was sort of intellectually alive, and he was aware of all that had happened in the 19th century in terms of kind of anti-supernaturalism and atheism, as you say, and he was able to answer that. Yes. But existentialism,
another big contribution that Schaefer made was with the popularization of Eastern religions and Eastern philosophy and thinking, which has just been coming over in wave after wave after wave. And again, his whole system of how do you have a reasonable discussion about what is true and, you know, all that we know was just so helpful. And with all the new experimental psychologies and so on as well. So the Eastern religions, the Maslow, the further reaches of human nature, and all these other things, he was just very, very able to. Well, he kept me very steady, working through all of that.
The great thing about one of the big things that Schaefer was good at in terms of explaining sort of Western thought was that finally it's impersonal. It's finally impersonal, because all you're left with is materialism.
Yes.
You're just left with matter. At the end of the day, you know, we're just stuff. But the interesting thing was he was able to say, ultimately, Eastern thought is saying the same thing too, because it's a monist sort of philosophy. And ultimately, it may not be stuff, but it's a spiritual reality which has no place for you and me.
Right.
Yes.
No sense of, because it's got no diversity, because it's a monist system as game. One is a materialist one, another is a kind of maybe a spiritual, ultimate spiritual reality, but they're both completely impersonal and indifferent.
Yes.
And they don't care. And I thought, that's helpful.
Yeah, that was.
That really was helpful.
Very, hugely. Yeah.
The monist could never say, I am one with God, because the I disappears when you become one.
I know. Hey, how does the I know?
The I
is one with God.
The I doesn't know, so once you get there, you don't even know it.
I know. Great. Thank you.
But you know, that's again, forces at such practical levels in our society and culture. We have lovely neighbours who are Buddhists, and you know, you just sort of have to listen and keep going.
And one of the things, and I should bring this to a close, but one of the things I've read, He Is There and He Is Not Silent, and some of his other books early on, and never once did I pick up on his mention even of Michael Polanyi.
Mm-hmm.
And that just was when I finally realized that, that helped me to understand why Schaeffer was not this dogmatist, though he had the confidence of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
He always realized that as Michael Polanyi reacted to the positivism, that, you know, the science could just give you absolute truth, and you see that didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Schaeffer, I think, was very much influenced by the Polanyi. Now, Polanyi didn't have a God, and he didn't have an answer, but Schaeffer saw that is... That's a key. So he learned from other people.
Yeah.
And what a surprise.
Yeah.
Is that he was dyslexic.
Yes. As Susan would say, so is she. And yet Susan, of course, you know, has taken so much of Schaeffer.
Yes.
And the school is, in a sense, the fruit of her writing her books.
Yes.
For the children's sake, and she's dyslexic.
Oh, is she?
Yes. Yeah. And Fiona says she's dyslexic, and RJ, Franel's son, also is. So it's a grand tradition.
It's a burden. I am, there's just some words I do not say in public. Just because I know I'm going to, but I switch letters.
Okay.
While I'm speaking.
Right.
I can't keep them separate.
Right.
So there's a Russian name, Olga.
Right.
And I knew a lady, she was a friend of a friend, but I would always, if I didn't, I had to really concentrate, so I know I'm going to meet her, I'm thinking it's O-L-O-L, Bruce. And I would invariably go, the
Olga.
G. Exactly. I'd get the G first.
Oh, Olga.
So nice to meet you.
Oh, yes.
Well.
Okay, excellent.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For this.
I wish you all the best on your endeavors.